You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, our guest says buildings have a life cycle just like people do. We'll find out about the new field of domecology.
First, it's time for our weekly review of state news. A lot more happened than the state budget making it out of the Joint Finance Committee. This week, former California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger told reporters in Wisconsin that the push to change the redistricting process is a lot like bodybuilding.
I mean, I remember with bodybuilding, it was the same thing. No one knew what the hell bodybuilding was. And then, you know, we had to kind of really promote it and talk and give speeches and write books and all this, and do documentaries like Pumping Iron. And then, eventually, it became popular and now everyone does it.
Schwarzenegger is one of a group of prominent national Republicans who support the challenge in the U.S. Supreme Court to Wisconsin's Republican-drawn district maps. Other supporters include U.S. Senator John McCain and Ohio Governor John Kasich.
Robert Menser is a senior statewide editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau, and he's with us about every Friday to look at the week's biggest news in Wisconsin. Rob, happy Friday.
Hey, thank you. Happy Friday to you as well.
So, Rob, why is Arnold Schwarzenegger weighing in on Wisconsin's redistricting challenge? What's going on?
Yes, this is a cause that Schwarzenegger has taken up post his governorship. And as you mentioned, he is not the only the only Republican on this issue, but it is notable that Republicans, including Schwarzenegger and Kasich and McCain, put their name on this amicus brief filed with the U.S. Supreme Court that takes the side of saying that Wisconsin's redistricting maps from 2010 should be ruled unconstitutional, and that politicians should not have as much leeway as Wisconsin Republicans claimed to choose their own voters.
And that messaging we just heard, it's just like bodybuilding. That's not one that we've heard from other supporters of this legal challenge. But what do you think about that? Is it
everything is like bodybuilding. If you really get right down to it, the analogy works for any effort. No, I mean, listen, there's something to it. Gerrymandering, redistricting maps is, it is not a sexy issue in the sense that it is highly technical. There are these parties that use these software programs and algorithms to determine the maps, and you can get very deep into the weeds when it comes to the question of exactly how much gerrymandering is allowed by law. But I mean, this is there is an underlying substantive issue here about democracy and representation, and so I take the analogy. He sees this as a long-term effort that takes years and years, and you have to put in a bunch of work, and it's not always fun. But then at the end, you get to look like Arnold Schwarzenegger, I guess.
And he walked the walk. He did some work on partisan redistricting in California, right?
Right. No, I mean, it's completely legit. It is not he is not new to the issue at all. It's a passion.
And Rob, where are we on the timeline in the Supreme Court challenge?
So this does get a bit confusing because there have been multiple legal challenges. This particular challenge to Wisconsin's 2010 map is not about racial makeup. That's been a cause of other challenges. In this case, it's about exactly how dramatically Republicans are allowed to advantage themselves. The case will go before the Supreme Court on October 3rd, and it's likely that the court would rule then sometime in 2018.
So coming up pretty soon, at least in the beginnings of it.
And in time for midterms.
And we're talking now with Rob Menser from USA Today, and we're talking about the biggest stories from Wisconsin this week. And on Wednesday, the Associated Press shared records that Attorney General Brad Schimel has spent about $83,000 on State Justice Department promotional items. Rob, what do you make of this story?
Yeah, it's a lot of swag. I mean, I found this story kind of fascinating, actually. So this is essentially a follow-up from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel in January reported that Schimmel spent $10,000 of taxpayer money to produce coins, these sort of commemorative coins that were notable because they bore the initials KAED, which is apparently stands for Schimmel's catchphrase, kicking ass every day. And some people thought maybe $10,000 of taxpayer money for KAED coins might have seemed excessive. So this is a sort of a follow-up on that. As of March, the Department of Justice said they will not be producing any more of the coins. But some of the numbers that revealed in this latest records that were released were $6,000 on branded pistol cases, $6,200 on messenger bags, and $3,200 on candy, as well as $100 on fortune cookies for some reason.
And these were used as giveaways at state conventions, right? That's what they were used for.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Schimmel's position here through a spokesman is that you always see swag at these sort of training events. The department puts on a lot of training events, and so if you break it down by everyone, some 10,000 people who've attended these things, it's not really that much money relative to the number of attendees at these trainings. So, you know, folks can take that for what it's worth.
And moving on to another story, Rob. Yesterday, Assembly Minority Leader Peter Barca from Kenosha announced that he's going to be stepping down from his leadership role. What's behind that change for him?
The word is Foxconn, it would seem. So, I mean, at the very least, that is what sort of forced Democrats to this point. Some Democrats say that there's been sort of discontent with Barca's leadership before this point. But really what seems to have led us here is the fact that Barca voted in favor of the governor's Foxconn incentives package, and in general was seen as a sort of a key ally in that effort. And for the leader of the Democratic Party, that some folks thought didn't care for that.
And do we have any idea who might replace Barca as minority leader?
Sure. We have, as of today, Representative Gordon Hintz of Oshkosh said he is in the running. Hintz is an energetic figure, and I think probably is fair to say just by demeanor, a little more combative. He's even been in trouble in the past for being a bit profane in his statements toward Republicans. So, what I think it speaks to is the sort of political approach that Wisconsin Democrats want to take here. It seems to me that you could read this as Democrats placing a bet that Foxconn is not going to be a political winner for Walker in 2018, and they want to be set up to have their clean opposition to Foxconn be an election issue in the midterms, or in Walker's reelection, rather.
I'll be watching to see what happens there. And finally, Rob, I don't know about in Wausau, in Madison, it's been a little chilly this week, and that's true. I think colors are ahead in northern Wisconsin. It looks like it's going to be an early fall.
It's fall. Veronica, it's here. I don't know what the calendar
winter is
says.
Coming. Is that what you're telling
it's
me?
Fall. It feels like fall. It is fall, is what I say.
Are you seeing colors where you are?
Barely. I mean, a little. But, I mean, it's certainly like even, it's like the last week of August, and you start to notice dry leaves on the sidewalk. Like, it feels like it's coming a little early. I would say it's barely any actual colors here, maybe a bit north of here. I hear tell that there are some, but they're coming. Yeah, and the latest prediction said an early fall this year for the fall colors, like middle of September, early, maybe the third week of September, we could be seeing some pretty colors.
So we got to get up there early if we're going to do our leaf peeping. Rob, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Robert Menser, senior statewide editor for USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau, and he's with us almost every Friday to look at Wisconsin's biggest headlines.
Abandoned homes in the United States reached a record high of 7.4 million 5 years ago. Those numbers represent an incredible amount of building materials that are likely to end up in a landfill.
Our next guest wants us to think about how to reuse materials from abandoned buildings and start thinking about those issues when we build new buildings.
He's invented a new word for the science of buildings and their life cycles, domacology. Rex Lamora is a director of Michigan State University's Center for Community and Economic Development, senior research specialist or outreach specialist, sorry, for MSU's Urban and Regional Planning Program. Rex, welcome to Central Time.
You're welcome. Thank you for the opportunity to share this work.
Well, first, explain the concept of domecology. What is it?
Domecology is a term that we created to try to help folks recognize that structures, man-made structures, have a life cycle. So we're really trying to redefine the relationship that we have with the built environment so that we recognize that when we build things, they're going to go through a period of use, possible reuse, reapplication, and then it's going to have an end of life, and then we'll look at how do we dispose of the material that was used in that structure and reuse, repurpose that material.
This is a problem that I think for a lot of us is out of sight, out of mind. We don't see a lot of abandoned homes and other buildings, and if we do, it's one here and there. How many structures are in this situation at any given time?
Oh, well, it's... We did an analysis of the Great Lakes and the metros within the Great Lakes, so it included the city of Milwaukee as well as Chicago and Detroit and the Clevelands and the Toledos and the Buffaloes, just the cities along the Great Lakes. And we found that there's an estimated over 200,000 abandoned structures in those communities across the Great Lakes region, and somewhere close to 7 million nationwide.
And that's a lot of buildings potentially... Well, maybe not a gold mine, but a construction materials mine. How much potential is there for reuse of the material in all those buildings?
Well, right now, the general paradigm with abandoned structures where we can find the resources is to demolish the structure and deposit the material in a landfill, which obviously has very little value to it. So we're looking at hopefully establishing a more environmentally sensitive, economically valuable, socially just concept of deconstructing these abandoned structures and salvaging that material. What tends to happen in our large cities, and I suspect this may be true in other cities like Milwaukee, is that when a structure goes into abandonment and becomes blighted, we have the scavengers that come in the evening and will pull out the valuable metals, the copper and the wiring. And then if you're an organized community, you may have architecturally valuable materials that people are trying to salvage, like oak floors or interesting architectural artifacts that are in the structure. And those might go to a warehouse or salvage facility where they're reused. And so what you end up with is what we call the high-volume, low-value material. It tends to be the wall studs, the asphalt shingles, some of the aggregate that's in the basement. So, again, it's high-volume material but relatively low value in the current market system. And most of that just gets pushed into a landfill. So we're trying to find reuse for that. Some of the aggregate can be reused for other materials. This would be like the cement and other things. The timber in the walls might be... Torrefied, turned into a coal-like product, or it might also be repurposed through a cross-laminated timber, and the asphalt shingles might be remelted and reused for road surfacing in other ways. So we're looking at that, what we're calling the deconstruction economic sector, that might capitalize on this material that we have in plenty around the Great Lakes.
What would it take to start, as you say, capitalize on deconstructing homes and other buildings? How do you get that critical mass where it's worth it for, say, my company or my city to put the effort into getting this heavy, cheap stuff in enough bulk to make it worthwhile?
Very good question. And that's part of the challenge of domecology, is to, again, try to help us rethink our paradigm of the life cycle of structures being one where we recognize that they have an end of life and that we have a responsibility at the end of that life to try to make maximum use of that resources. So part of what we're trying to do is help people conceive of methods that might maximize the economic profitability of this material. So, for example, we did a feasibility study again, looking at the Great Lakes catchment area, the possibility of collecting this material around the Great Lakes and shipping it to a single port of entry that might attract those industries. There are in Europe, for example, industries that make use of these materials. They're relatively more efficient at repurposing this material than we are. And it looks feasible, except for one slight problem, which is most of the shipping on the Great Lakes is what is called bulk hold shipping, the large ships that carry bulk material in the hold. And most of this material that we might salvage out of these structures may have lead contamination or asbestos material in there, which of course would contaminate that bulk hold. So what we probably need to look at is establishing a container shipping capacity within the Great Lakes that would allow, if you think about how these structures come down on site, where, say, for example, your local land bank or your local government is tearing down a blighted and abandoned structure, rather than throwing it into the back of a dump truck, they would load it into the back of a cargo container, fill that container up, move it to the port, put it on a ship, move it over to some central location. Now you have a bulk material system that makes it more economically feasible. So it's going to take a series of policy conversations about, do we really want to fill up our landfills with this material? Might there be other uses for it? This will never end under our current paradigm. New construction today is likely to be 30, 40 years out, our abandoned structures. So we really need to have a rather long conversation about the tools, models, policies, and practices that will help us end this sort of silliness that we have with structures.
We're talking about abandoned buildings and how to make use of them with Rex Lamore from Michigan State University, the concept of domicology. And Rex, we've been focusing on the end of the building's life cycle. Let's go to the beginning. You're hoping for changes in the way we build buildings in the first place, so that years, decades later, we can more easily access the materials and find a new use for them. What would that look like?
Yep. If you think about it, when we build it, we have a responsibility for its end of life. So you're going to think about, okay, at the end of the life of that structure, I'm going to want to maximize the value of the materials that I've invested in that structure. So you're going to do what is called in the field design for deconstruction. You're going to use connectors, as simple as using screws versus glue, so that at the end of the life of the structure, it's much easier to extract the valuable materials that are there rather than try to pull it apart now, which is a very difficult process with our current construction methods. So we're looking at a different design model. We're looking at a different construction model that facilitates the deconstruction of these materials. And it's a long-term conceptualization of our built environment relationship that really requires us to think about these things having a life cycle.
Are there architects and designers and builders who are starting to think this way when it comes to planning and building a building?
Yes, exactly. There, in fact, some of the modular housing has many of the components that are elements of the deconstruction model. So yes, there is methods that are under being used now by some construction industries, very progressive, forward-thinking industries, in terms of using modular construction methods that facilitate deconstruction at the end of the life of the structure. The other part of that long-term thinking is, how do we secure the resources, the financial resources, at the beginning of a construction so that at the end of the life of the structure, there are financial resources to remove that structure? The way that this is being financed now in much of the United States, certainly in the Midwest, is the public sector taxpayers are paying for the blight of the removal of these blighted structures. So the private landowner builds it, uses it, walks away from it, and leaves the taxpayer with the burden of removing that structure. So might there be other methods at the beginning of the life of a structure where we might secure financial resources that, so at the end of the life of the structure, the taxpayer is not burdened with the cost of removal. So things like bonding is one that's been looked at, and there are examples where bonds have been used, for example, on cell towers, which obviously present a clear public health and safety hazard. If they're abandoned, they might fall over, cause property damage or loss of life. Same thing with large electric generating windmills. Those companies are required to post a bond at the point of construction, so that at the end of the useful life of that windmill generator, they're able to have the financial resources to take that windmill down so it's not, a public health and safety hazard. Pipelines, the same thing. Oil rigs, which we don't have too many of here in the Great Lakes, but certainly are present in other parts of the United States. So we have examples where we've seen the value of establishing a financial mechanism. We've also been looking at, and this is just in preliminary research, the possibility of creating something like an insurance policy. So over the life of the structure, a third party, an insurance company, would collect a premium from the user of that structure so that at the end of the life of that structure, residential, commercial, or industrial structure, there would be a third party with the resources to remove that structure. And one of the values of that is it spreads the cost of deconstruction over the useful life of that structure, so the first person to build it doesn't incur the whole cost, but it also allows for the monitoring of the use of that structure. So if you think of a commercial property, for example, goes through multiple uses. It might start out as a dentist office or and end up being a dry cleaner, and during that period of use, there may or may not be different environmental impacts, which might increase the cost of cleanup and removal of that structure. You've got that third-party insurance company monitoring that use, adjusting that premium, just like an auto insurance company would do if you were a bad driver, so that they have the resources at the end of the use of that structure, the end of the useful life of that structure, to remove that structure. So you kind of move a third party into this that has that financial obligation rather than a general taxpayer.
A lot to think about, Rex. Yep. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're welcome, and thank you for sharing this.
Rex Lamar is director of Michigan State University's Center for Community and Economic Development and senior outreach specialist for MSU's Urban and Regional Planning Program. He joined us to talk about this idea of domecology.
There were many reactions to President Trump's announcement earlier this week that he would rescind the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, or DACA. One of the earliest was from the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, which in a statement referred to the cancellation of the program as, quote, reprehensible. The group pledged to protect those who would be subject to deportation.
Some faith leaders, including evangelical advisors to the president and the National Association of Evangelicals, focused on the six-month delay and the opportunity for Congress to put a new program in place. The majority of statements, including those from a range of Catholic, Protestant, Jewish, and Muslim groups, expressed their support for the continuation of DACA and the 800,000 people directly affected.
Jim Wallace was among those who criticized the change to DACA from a faith perspective. He's the president and founder of Sojourners, which is a Christian social justice publishing and advocacy organization. His most recent book is called America's Original Sin: Racism, White Privilege, and the Bridge to a New America. Jim, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
Well, why do you see support of DACA as an expression of your faith?
Well, for us, this is more theological than political. I mean, Jesus said very clearly in the 25th chapter of Matthew, I was a stranger and you didn't welcome me. So how we treat the stranger, which means the immigrant, the refugee, is literally how we treat Christ himself. That's why you've seen so many statements from so many churches across the political spectrum saying this is a faith issue for us. It's an issue of cruelty. There's 800,000 people. These all have faces, and some of these young dreamers that work for us at Sojourners. I've been on the phone with them. They're in tears. They're living in fear. They've never lived anywhere but America. They came here as kids. And I think you're going to find a real unity in the faith community against Donald Trump's policy here. And we are going to unify on the Congress, because this shouldn't be a partisan issue. These young people are good for the country. They're working. They got jobs. They're in school, they're in the military, they're contributing, and to rip them away from their families makes no sense at all.
Did it surprise you that from a wide variety of organizations and voices in the faith community that there was such broad support for DACA? It wasn't just from one sector of the faith community,
right,
but from many different areas. Did that come as a surprise?
It didn't come as a surprise at all, because we have been united, many of us, around the need for immigration reform. What we need here, really, finally, is comprehensive immigration reform. And we've all been in favor of that, Catholics and Protestants and evangelicals and Jews and Muslims. So there is really wide agreement in the faith community about the need for immigration reform. But in the short term, we totally supported DACA, this effort to protect young people who are in great jeopardy. They live here. They're Americans. They're contributing. Many have never even been to the countries that they're brought here as kids from. So there is great unity here across our political boundaries. And as I say, this isn't a partisan issue for us, even just a political issue. It's a faith issue. It's a theological issue. The Bible is clear about how we treat immigrants. And so that's why we're united. So I wasn't surprised at all. And that means Donald Trump and the Congress are going to face a unified faith community on this issue of protecting those dreamers and restoring DACA and doing more. Let's do comprehensive immigration reform, because we desperately need that.
Former White House Chief Strategist Steve Bannon was interviewed by Charlie Rose this week for CBS 60 Minutes segment. It aired Sunday. And on that program, Bannon spoke out against President Trump's decision to end the DACA program. And he specifically lashed out at leaders of the Catholic Church who condemned the president's decision.
The bishops have been terrible about this. By the way, you know why? You know why? Because unable to really to come to grips with the problems in the church, they need illegal aliens. They need illegal aliens to fill the churches. It's obvious on the face of it. That's what the entire Catholic bishops condemning. They have an economic interest. They have an economic interest in unlimited immigration, unlimited illegal immigration.
And what do you say to that about what Steve Bannon has said there about the Catholic Church and what their stake in this might be?
Bannon's a fool. He's a fool. He's a moral fool. He has no credibility whatsoever to speak about churches. Bannon has promoted racial bigotry. Bannon has created the platform for the alt-right. The alt-right is a white supremacist network and movement. So Steve Bannon has no credibility in the churches whatsoever. No church leader I know even knows him or has any respect for him. So this is for us a faith issue. Bannon has been on the wrong side on racial justice questions for a long time. So none of us have any respect for Steve Bannon. None.
Talking with Jim Wallace right now, president and founder of Sojourners. It's a Christian social justice publishing and advocacy organization in Washington, D.C. He's also an author. His most recent book is called America's Original Sin, looking at the response in the faith community to the repeal of DACA. And Jim, the percentage of Americans who say that they're affiliated with a religion is dropping. But even though the United States can be thought of as a secular nation, about 80% of people consider themselves believers. How do you think that those numbers should impact and influence legislation and policies?
Well, most Americans also favor the kids, the dreamers, who are in danger of being deported because of Donald Trump's decision here. So we have more than 70% of American people are for it. So the faith community, you're going to see real unity. We're going to be protecting these kids. If they come after, I talked to a young woman just last night who worked as Sojourners for years. She is undocumented, a dreamer. Her parents brought her when she was just a kid. And she's a wonderful Christian, wonderful worker. She's gone to school. She worked for us. If they come after her, I'm going to invite her to come and live in my house. And ICE can come and arrest her by coming through my house. So we're going to protect these kids in our churches, in our homes, our schools, our seminaries. And if they want to come after the kids, they're going to have to go through us first.
That's an interesting point. It brings up a comparison to the 1980s when U.S. churches, some of them sheltered Central Americans who were fleeing
That's
violence
right.
in their own countries. Do you see another broad-based movement like that in the faith community that could happen again?
It's already happening. In fact, I mentioned the scripture in Matthew 25 in the gospel where Jesus says, I was a stranger. That text, it's really the text that brought me to my faith out of the student movement back in the 1960s, where Jesus said, I was hungry, I was thirsty, I was naked, I was a stranger, I was in prison, I was sick, and you didn't come to me. And they all said, Lord, when do we see you hungry and naked and sick, a stranger in prison? He said, as you've done it to the least of these, you've done that to me. That was my conversion text that brought me out of the student movement to my own faith in Christ. And so that text is now rising up out of the streets where people are working with immigrants. They're using Matthew 25. So a number of us have begun something called the Matthew 25 Pledge. It's a new movement. It's a pledge. It says, I will protect vulnerable people in Jesus' name. So all over the country, this gospel text is rising up in the streets, literally. And so that Matthew 25 pledge, people can find out about it on our website, sojo.net, S-O-J-O.net. You can find the Matthew 25 pledge. We've got toolkits. We've got resources. So we are ready to protect undocumented people in our churches, in our homes, in our seminaries. And the White House and the Republicans and the Democrats are going to see a real unified faith community in this country to protect those dreamers, because Jesus says how we treat them is literally how we treat him.
Now, right now, as we were talking about, there is a broad coalition. There are evangelicals, there are Lutherans, there,
right.
there are Baptists. Do you see a point where this coalition could break down along different, not party lines, but different beliefs as we go forward, as it does get deeper into the politics of it in Congress and beyond?
No, I don't think so, because this is for us, as I said before, not a political issue, but a theological issue. So it's our scriptures that bring us together. And it's our relationship. There's a pastor, for example, in Southern California. He's been a pastor for 27 years. He's an Assemblies of God pastor. He's caring for a church. He's married to an American citizen. His kids are American citizens. And he checked in with ICE every single year, just to tell them where he was, to check in. He's broken no laws. He's a pastor. Now they've detained him, Pastor Noe, N-O-E. They've detained him. ICE detained him, and they're going to deport him. It makes no sense at all. He's broken no laws. He's contributing. And so they're deporting our pastors, our brothers and sisters. These are people we have relationship to. They aren't just sort of objects of politics. These are brothers and sisters in Christ with whom we have relationship. So we're going to protect them in the church, in the body of Christ. This is for us a faith issue. It's a fellowship issue. So, no, I think this is one thing that we will stay united around.
We're talking right now with Jim Wallace about the response by faith communities and religious organizations to the repeal of DACA. Wallace is a public theologian as well as president and founder of Sojourners, a Christian social justice publishing and advocacy organization.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. If you are a person of faith, how does that influence how you feel about DACA and immigration? What other policy issues do you feel your faith informs your response to? Do you think that speaking out on policy issues is an important expression of your faith? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org.
We'll continue our conversation here on Central Time in just a bit.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard, and we're continuing our conversation with Jim Wallace, public theologian and president and founder of Sojourners, a Christian social justice publication. We're looking at the faith response to the repeal of Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Program, or DACA.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. How does your faith, if any, inform your thoughts on issues like DACA, immigration, deportation? What do you do if your beliefs on any issue are contradicted by law and government policy? And if you're not a member of a faith community, do you think those beliefs should play a role in public policy making and decisions, government approaches? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Let's take our first caller. We've got Jim with us in Rice Lake. Jim, hi.
Well, I very much support, you know, the positions and the statements of your guests, but I just, my disagreement is political. I think that the born-again Christian community is not as much behind DACA or immigration protection as he implies. I mean, they were the bread and butter of Donald Trump's election in the last presidential campaign, and they knew his positions on immigration when they voted for him. So I don't know that there is this broad, I mean, I think the establishment church is Catholic, Protestant, Episcopalian, you know, Baptist. A lot of these are with your speaker, but I think that a sizable section of the born-again movement is not with him, and I'd be interested in his response. Thank you.
All right, Jim, thank you for that call. And to you, Jim, what do you think about that? He says the coalition may
be
not as broad. Born-agains may not be on board.
Yeah. I'm an evangelical, so I'm in the evangelical community. And what's interesting, which most Americans don't know, is that when we had a chance to pass immigration reform last time, a couple of years back, a majority of Christians and a majority of evangelicals, even a majority of white evangelicals, were in favor of immigration reform. So we do have strong support among evangelicals for that. Now, 81% of white evangelicals voted for Donald Trump. He's right, and that's true. But many of those evangelicals don't agree with his stance on this question. They voted for him for other reasons that were things on their minds and hearts. But evangelicals in general include evangelicals of color. So black evangelicals and Hispanic evangelicals did not vote in majority for Donald Trump. They voted against him. So it was white evangelicals who voted for Donald Trump. But even many of those white evangelicals, some of them don't agree with him on these issues, on immigration issues. So I think it is true. Your caller is suggesting something that's happened that's very dangerous, which is Donald Trump. He played on fear and really played on hate. Donald Trump used racial bigotry. And on the day he entered this election campaign, he really assaulted immigrants and Hispanic people. He called them criminals and rapists. So Donald Trump uses and fuels racial bigotry for his own purposes. And many Christians are opposed to that in principle because racial bigotry is completely contrary to the gospel of Jesus Christ. So I'm an evangelical and I support immigration reform, and many evangelicals do. Certainly Hispanic evangelicals do, and black evangelicals do, and younger white evangelicals do too. And I would say anybody that's in relationship with immigrants in their churches or in their communities, relationships bring us together. So when you meet people and you hear their stories and you know what their lives are like, you tend to support them and support them as part of this country and part of our churches. So your caller is raising an issue that's an important one, but evangelicals have come together around this question, and some don't agree, that's for sure. But most of us, I think, if we're going to include evangelicals of color, which we have to and should, would support these immigration, these immigrants, because, as I keep saying, this is a biblical issue for us and how we treat those who are undocumented, how we treat Christ himself.
Jim, thanks for bringing up that question. Appreciate that. And just briefly before we move on to our next call, we talked earlier about Steve Bannon, his remarks about the Catholic Church. That interview will be airing next Sunday. It has not aired yet. That was a clip from what is coming up on Sunday. Let's go to another caller. This is Syed in Madison. Syed, hi.
Hi. I'm a Muslim living in Madison as an immigrant, and all that DACA situation, like, I just want to share my thoughts. When Prophet Muhammad moved from Mecca to Medina as an immigrant, he was welcome. Same in Christianity. I do not understand these good people. They pay tax. They live in this country. Why we make their life so difficult? That really makes my heart. I feel pain in my heart to think about them as an immigrant.
Syed, thank you for that call. And what goes through your head as you listen to Syed, Jim?
Well, I agree with him. I feel the pain side in my heart, too. And the Matthew 25 pledge that I mentioned a few minutes ago focuses on three groups of people who are in danger. Now, one is undocumented immigrants. Number two is young people of color facing racialized policing in their communities. And three, Muslims. Muslims who are have been come under attack. Again, Donald Trump has assaulted, has attacked, has accused Muslims of all being terrorists. It's really irresponsible. And so many of us as Christians have reached out to our Muslim brothers and sisters and are going to support them. And so if there ever was and some of Donald Trump's advisors have called for things like this, if there ever was any effort to register Muslims or have them stand in line, a number of us would stand in line ahead of them to say, no, you can't do this. So protecting Muslims is also for us a faith issue. So I have the same broken heart, Saeed, you do about this, but I'm glad that we can act and live together in some real support and solidarity for each other.
And Jim, I want to ask you, I think that for at least in the past, when we think about issues that are influenced by faith, we think about issues like abortion and same-sex marriage, two issues that come to mind. And it seems as though recently there have been broad faith coalitions coming together around the proposed Muslim ban, the attempted repeal now to the attempted repeal of DACA. Do you think that the faith community is broadening its usual territory on this kind of thing lately?
Well, the religious right has focused on those two issues that you mentioned, but many of us in the faith community for a long time have focused more broadly. And so Sojourners, for your listeners who know us, is a broad network and movement of putting faith into action for social justice on a whole variety of issues. We've been doing that for a long time. So we're an alternative, you might say, to the religious right. But there's got to be a consistency. When the Pope was here in Washington, he was speaking to the Congress, you might recall that speech, and he said, I care about the sanctity and dignity of life. And all the Republicans rose, thinking he was speaking only of abortion. And then he said, and that's why I'm against capital punishment. The Democrats rose, everyone sat down. No one knew whether to stand up or sit down. Cardinal Bernardin of Chicago, who was one of my favorite cardinals, talked about a consistent ethic of life, a seamless garment of life, where you want to defend life wherever it is threatened. And we have a selectivity on the left and the right of what kind of life they want to defend. So a more consistent ethic of the dignity of life is what many of us are drawn to, not just singling out one issue. And so on poverty, for example, there's a broad coalition that includes the Catholic bishops, the Salvation Army, Bread for the World, and Sojourners. We coordinate that coalition. It's called the Circle of Protection. And we are called together to protect low-income people in all these budget debates that want to cut taxes for the wealthy by cutting effective programs for the poor, like food stamps. And so on health care, there was a broad agreement, the Catholic bishops, the National Association of Evangelicals, Salvation Army, Sojourners, many of us who are not just religious left at all, said we have to defend programs like Medicaid, which protect low-income people primarily. So there's a lot of unity around those questions, and the media hears from the right and tends to undercover all the people who care about other issues besides just the ones lifted up by the far right people.
And we leave it there. Jim, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for the conversation. It was a good one.
Jim Wallace is an evangelical Christian, public theologian, and the president and founder of Sojourners, a Christian social justice publishing organization, responding there to President Trump's repeal of the DACA program.